This public radio podcast is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its Campaign for Love and Forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org, and by Diana Kennedy's The Art of Mexican Cooking, the ultimate guide to creating authentic Mexican food in your own kitchen with more than 200 beloved recipes. First published in 1989, it's back in print with a new introduction.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Today we're bringing you the first of two special shows that we recorded in Italy. My Italy, the place of my heart and the Italy few people know. I'm taking you inside the life of the first Splendid Table, my book on Italy's culinary capital, the Emilia-Romagna region. Now, in 1982, when I first started researching the book, my interest was purely professional and extremely critical. I was not a neophyte. I mean, I understood that if you're a serious student of Italian food, you have to spend time in Emilia-Romagna, because it's only there that Italy's three most famous foods can happen: Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, Parma ham, and that aged nectar, balsamic vinegar. In 1982, handmade was everything, and it had been for centuries. Women had thriving businesses making handmade pasta that was the envy of all of Italy. People savored culatello ham the way wine lovers take on Chateau Petrus. Parmigiano-Reggiano cheesemakers apprenticed 14 years to earn the right to make the cheese, and it was a bite of that cheese that stopped me in my tracks. Now, I grew up on Parmigiano, but not like this. It was astounding. And the same thing happened with my first bowl of tortellini and capon broth at Villa Gaidello. Then there was my first taste of 100-year-old balsamic. Look, there's great food all over Italy, but Emilia-Romagna was over the top. What was going on here? I mean, why all of this in one region? Well, those were the questions I answered in my book. Well, now it's 13 years later. Is all that excellence alive and well? With not a little trepidation, I decided to set out to see if you can go home again in Emilia-Romagna. When I get to Italy, I love to set up base camp in the city of Parma. I love Parma's attitude. Since the 1500s, she's been a center of power, learning, and the arts. And she knows it. She's elegant, graceful, and the Parmigiani know in their hearts of hearts that they're superior to other beings. But what's nice is their noblesse oblige. It makes them extremely kind and gracious to the rest of us. So as usual, I dropped my bags at the hotel, rounded up the crew, and headed out to one of Parma's golden oldies, the Salumeria Garibaldi. You walk through the door and you can smell the smell of ripe, delicious meat. And hanging along the wall are whole Parma hams, and there's salami everywhere. And in the cases are incredible prepared foods like meatballs and roasted chicken and little rolled up pork loins that have been stuffed with pancetta. There's veal that's in a tomato sauce. There's all kinds of cheeses, fresh and aged. And one of the things you see in a salumeria in Emilia-Romagna will be a selection of hams. They're always in the open air, and they will be cut in different ways. And the reason why is that in this area where the ham is king, everybody likes a different part of the ham. So you'll see a center cut, which is the largest part of the ham. That will be for people who like it very delicate, because the cure doesn't penetrate as strongly into the thickest part of the meat. Then you'll see pieces of ham, other hams, that are smaller. They're more salty, essentially. They're stronger flavored. They're the narrower part of the leg that absorbs much more of the salt. So you come in and you will ask for the ham you want. Also, the hams might be of different ages. So you might have the same ham from the same maker, but it might be 24 months, it might be 30 months, it might be 36 months. And you can actually specify how many months you would like with your ham. In addition to that, you will see all kinds of other cut
salami, cured shoulder, but always at room temperature, because remember, these things are aged not in refrigerators, but they're aged out in the open. And of course, the salumeria is always a cool place. Quanto mese c'è questi prosciutti? I'm asking, how old is the prosciutto that I'm seeing here?
26.
26? So, 26 months. È possibile avere un mezzetto?
Certo.
Sì, c'è niente di più stagionata?
No.
No. I'm asking, is there anything that's older? We'll take the center cut, quella, per favore. We're going to take the center cut. E questa è tagliata a mano?
Questo? Questa è una parte del fiocco.
We're talking now about a different cut of ham that's not made in the mountains like prosciutto di Parma. It's made out where in a plain near the Po River where it's very moist, humid, warm, and they take the main muscle of the leg and they cure it. And it's called culatello. It is double the cost of a prosciutto. And right now, the gentleman who has the salumeria is bringing us tastes of prosciutto di Parma and Parmigiano Reggiano. We're having lunch. Oh, guys, taste this. Molto grazie. Oh, my. Questo è buonissimo.
Questo è da il più buono. Quello che ha preso il primo premio.
This
come miglior parmigiano.
Sì, primo premio, quando?
L'ha preso l'anno scorso. Mi dice quando.
He is saying that this parmigiano won first prize as the best parmigiano reggiano in all of Italy last year. E da dove?
Viene qui sulle colline di Parma, sulle colline di Berceto. Casa selvatica di Berceto.
Ah, sì, the wild house. He's saying it comes from a cheesemaker in the town of Berceto, which is in the foothills of Parma, and they call it the wild place of Berceto because it's in the hills. And this cheese tastes like concentrated, delicious homemade broth that had a run-in with cream. It's the only way I can begin to describe it. The prosciutto... Oh, you haven't tasted ham until you've had prosciutto, don't you agree? It's sweet. It's never salty. It's like concentrated, delicious, the ultimate experience in pig.
Mm.
Would you like a little bit of wine?
Si.
Would you like to know?
Poco, poco.
Si, grazie. We're being offered a glass of wine. Now, we've come into a store and we've asked for, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. And we've come in the store just to ask information and buy a little bit, like, you know, 2 ounces of ham. And we're about to have wine. After this, we'll probably have hors d'oeuvres, and then we'll be invited to lunch. See why you fall in love with the place.
The Salumeria Garibaldi is on Via Garibaldi. And by the way, the cardinal sin that you can commit in Parma with culatello and prosciutto is to have anything else on your plate. Never melon. Just straight ham, unadorned. Oh, down the street from the Salumeria on the other side, check out the biggest and fanciest looking pastry shop. Now, I can't remember the name, but it's a good spot for breakfast, cappuccino, and pastry, and for observing La Bella Figura in action. Now, La Bella Figura is Italian mentality in material form. It means to present only your best self to the world. And no one does it better than the elegant Parma woman taking an espresso break.
And I have to say, I did not have... Now, this is so totally snotty.
Good.
I did not have a great coffee today.
I really think we can't go through a day and not have a good coffee.
Well, the search goes on.
This was the biggest surprise of the trip, the coffee. I mean, really great cups were few and far between. We were stunned. I mean, Italy used to be coffee paradise. Well, a friend sent us to his favorite bar in Bologna, Café degli Uffizi. Now, it's a typical modern bar, small, immaculate, throbbing techno with wines and liquors. But in pride of place is the espresso machine, topped with little cups and fronted by a sweep of bar. You know, you drink coffee standing up in most Italian bars. Well, we were told to ask for the barista, Damiano. He was cute, dark hair, great smile. But of course, the big question was, can he make coffee?
Now, there are three secrets to a good espresso. C'è tre segreti di un buon espresso. Cos'è?
Si dice che per avere un ottimo espresso c'è...
It said the secrets to a good espresso are the famous three M's. La mano, the hand, la miscela, the coffee blend, and la macchina, the machine. With these three working, a cup of good espresso is a guarantee.
È possibile, could you show me how you make a really good cup of espresso?
Right away. The first I do is set out the service for the coffee, the saucer, spoon, and we always want you to have a swallow of bubbly water because we want you to cleanse your palate before you drink the coffee.
So deve bevere prima. He's given me a glass of bubbly water, and the idea is that it's going to clean my palate, so I drink it before I have the coffee. How do you pack that? Come le fa questo compressione, vorrei dire?
It is compressed, not too much. It must be light. It changes only with the grind of the coffee, but that only changes with the humidity, so the pressure is light. The measure is 7 grams of coffee. The machine is set for 7 grams. Each cup needs that amount.
And if you have a lot of humidity, do you change?
If you have a lot of humidity, you do a coarser grind. And you have to press the coffee in the basket a little more. Now, the cup must be hot. If the cup isn't hot, the espresso doesn't develop its cream. We call the foam the cream.
And the machine that you're using, tell me about the machine.
The machine is above all a professional machine from the Vega company. Most important, it is a Calvia. This means it maintains the same pressure and temperature always. The more you use it, the better the coffee. If you don't have that for each cup, you don't make espresso.
Now, how, in looking at the coffee, how do I know if it's made correctly?
First, you must look at the color. Coffee with a pale color says it wasn't made with enough coffee, or the right blend. Then look at the coffee's creaminess, its very own creamy foam topping. This is the sign of a true espresso. Taste it without sugar. Espresso should not have a lot of acid. If it is arrogant in your mouth, acidic, then it isn't good.
The crema is light, pale, coffee-colored foam, and he's right. There's no real acid. There's a tartness at the finish, but there's no acidity and there's no bitterness. È buono, è molto corposo, vorrei dire.
Yes, and the temperature is so important. We say espresso should burn the lips, almost. Caffè espresso has to be drunk immediately.
One gulp. Oh, God, that's good. How did you become a barista? How many years?
It's 17 years. I started as a baby, really at 15. I didn't want to study. And I want to do this. I started cleaning the glasses, the janitor. Then slowly, slowly I was allowed to make some panino, some coffee. And now this bar is all mine.
Thank you very much. Molto grazie.
Grazie a voi. Grazie di tutto.
Tia Miano is owner and barista of Bar degli Orifici in Bologna. Now, for more information, visit the website splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, be sure to register for our brand new limited run e-newsletter and information on its sister podcast. Both are called How to Eat Supper because, well, they're based on our brand new book of the same name, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Every week for a limited time, we're going to send you a new recipe from the book, and we've put together even more tips and information relating to that week's topic on the How to Eat Supper podcast. And best of all, they're both free. So register for them both, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the Pasta Queen teaches adult ed. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com.
Well, you're listening to a special broadcast, The Splendid Table in Italy. This week and next, we're going to be taking you to the scene of the first Splendid Table, the book I did on Italy's culinary capital, the Emilia-Romagna region. For my money, no place in Italy has pasta to beat out Emilia-Romagna. It is so light, it practically levitates. Now, all the time that I worked in the region, every eatery, nearly every deli and bakery, not to mention the pasta shops, had a woman who came in the morning, poured a mountain of flour on a work table, broke eggs into it, and then, by hand, she worked a dough, rested it, and with a rolling pin, rolled out, cut, and shaped every pasta sold that day. She was a respected professional. Her title was La Sfoglina, my translation, the Lady of the Leaves, because sfoglia means leaf or sheet in Italian. Now, every town had pasta shops run by sfoglinas. Many were my teachers, and now most are gone. Well, to explain the disappearance, I went to Giovanni Tamburini. Now, his Bologna food shop is a curated collection of the best that Emilia-Romagna has to offer. Giovanni guards traditions the way he'd guard his children. Standing next to the pasta counter, we caught up on the latest in pasta politics.
The last time that we met, we were at a conference in Rome, and you talked about the tradition of the sfoglina, of the woman who makes pasta, used to actually be a business where you could go into a store in Bologna and she would have her own business, hand-rolling and hand-making pasta. And you said it was endangered.
The
problem has not been resolved because the European law says even with a very low bacteria count, the pasta is not safe. The pasta was safe and it was clean. This is one of the oldest business in our part of Italy. Pasta rolled with a rolling pin by hand.
So you are saying that the women who used to have these businesses can no longer have them?
Ma anche prima, perché Europa ha usato la nostra legge?
Well, this is how it worked. The new laws from the European Union were set for very, very low bacteria count. And they said hands could not touch the pasta. If you violated the law, you were penalized with big penalties taken into court. The women couldn't fight it. They didn't have the money or the politics, so most of them closed down. I spent a lot of money setting up a factory to the new codes, pasta made by machines. It didn't go. The pasta was terrible. Look, the law is ridiculous. Go to a fish shop. Bacteria is everywhere. But you cook the fish and it's okay. Pasta is not close to fish and bacteria. But the point is, you have to cook it. They didn't close the fish shops. So I went to the Secretary of Sanitation, the head here in Bologna, and I said, I'm going back to the old way. I will hire the women who are the experts, the sfoglinas, and we will have our handmade pasta. The day you come in here to stop us, it will be like the kiss of Judas.
So, ora, now, what is it? Now, have they tried to close
you? No, non vengono, ma il giorno che c'è questo problema, io ho avvisato.
Well, the laws are still the same, but the day they come in to enforce it, I close everything.
And e non ha arrivato, and they have not come. Va bene.
No, they have not come.
Capito forse, è difficile,
Giovanni, molto grazie.
Grazie, non niente, poi.
Giovanni Tamburini's shop in Bologna is called Tamburini, la antica salsamenteria di Bologna. Now, this dilemma of local and traditional versus industrial and standardized goes deep in Europe. Taking away that handmade pasta is like taking away your social security number. But Antonella Fila is not letting it go without a fight. She's the latest winner of the Super Bowl of Pasta, Emilia-Romagna's yearly TV competition, Il Mattarello d'Oro, the golden rolling pin. Now, Antonella took the professional category, but she's decided to teach home cooks. She does adult ed classes in her home village of Cavezzo, and she invited us to sit in. So here's the scene. We're in Cavezzo's spanking new town meeting hall. Antonella is in sleek black with her golden rolling pin on her lapel. Now, 12 women are working dough at tables around the room, teasing each other. The usual characters are in place. Paola, with the wild blonde hair, is the hairdresser and instigator. Angela, the policewoman, warns that if we criticize her dough, she'll ticket the car. The cultural minister has come to greet us, and every man over 50 who owns a camera is snapping away. Well, the students have been meeting for at least 10 minutes. It seems like it's time to start rolling the pasta, and I couldn't resist a play-by-play.
Now it's time to start rolling the pasta. And if you haven't seen a pasta rolling pin that's used in Italy, it's not at all like the kind of rolling pin we have in our kitchens. It's long and narrow. In fact, what it looks like is a very thick broom handle. And everybody in the class has brought their own rolling pin. In fact, they have their own cloth sacks that they carry them in, and they carry them sort of over their shoulder, like yoga mats. And the pins are, 39, 40, 45 inches long and maybe an inch and a quarter in diameter. And now our teacher, Signora Fila, is kneading this dough. It's almost creamy in appearance. It's absolutely smooth, and it's that chrome yellow. And they've been kneading, easily 10 minutes, easily. Quanto tempo vuoi per lavorare?
Non è questione di tempo. La pasta deve essere liscia, morbida. Adesso è pronta.
I asked her, how long do you need? And she said, it's not a question of how long. It's a question of when the pasta is ready. And I've just felt the pasta. And you wouldn't believe this. It feels cool. It feels almost a little damp, but it's absolutely smooth. I mean, it's almost as smooth as marble. And you can mush it in your hand, but there's nothing sticky about it or overly soft.
Adesso siamo pronti per iniziare a tirare la pasta.
She keeps working it in her hand and turning it around in her hand and squeezing. She says, now it's ready to be rolled out. Oh, yeah. Ooh, boy, do you want to get your hands into that. Oh, all right, now she's sprinkled flour, very, very little flour on the board. And now she's pressing this dough. It's in a round, and she's pressing it with the palms of her hands, with the heel of the hand, not the fingers. And she sprinkled just a little flour on it. And now it's about a half inch thick, and she has it near her on the board, and she's calling the student over, and she's picking up the long rolling pin. Okay. This is like play-by-play at a sport. Okay, now she hasn't floured the rolling pin at all, but the student has started to work the dough. She's rolling the rolling pin with the flat of her hand, and she rolls the dough from the center out, turns it a quarter turn, rolls the next section, turns it a quarter turn. So she's always working from the center, and she's always working a quarter turn.
Mi ha detto che va molto bene perché ha le bolle, vedi?
Sì.
E quindi è stata lavorata molto bene.
Incorporata molta aria, molto lavorata.
All right, now, Paola, her dough has been worked especially well, the teacher says, because her dough has air in it. Bolle, you want to say there's actually holes of air, right? And that shows it's very light. And I'm actually seeing they're blisters. They're blisters of air. And she's saying that shows her dough has been worked absolutely perfectly. Ma... È benissima questa, è bellissima.
Sono bravissima.
Sì.
Sono splendida.
She's saying I'm very good. In fact, I'm splendid.
Ora la mettiamo per un terzo giù, tre terzi su.
What she's explaining is now the dough's been rolled out and it's perhaps almost about 24 inches in diameter. And she says at this point, you want to let about a third of the dough hang off the table and about two-thirds of the dough to be on the table because there's a new movement that you do. You roll the pasta dough back on the rolling pin and stretch it from the center. And if you do it with all of the pasta on the table, you lean over too far, you hurt your back. So it's always hanging off. It's also helping stretch it, always from the center.
La pasta è pronta, è sottile al punto giusto, quando se metti un giornale sotto riesci a leggerlo.
She's saying that you know the pasta is rolled thin enough when you can put a newspaper underneath it and you're able to read it.
The dough was a big, bright yellow round. Now, then Signora Fila cut some classic Emilia-Romagna shapes. First, the pasta that made slaves of women, the hollow garganelli, used to be made by hemp weavers on loom combs. Little rectangles turned on point, rolled around a dowel as they're pressed into a ribbed board. You get a hollow, narrow, ribbed little tube of pasta. After Garganelli, she did the ragged and random cuts called mal tagliati, or badly cut. This is soup pasta. Finally, she demonstrated the king. The pasta Central Emilia-Romagna claims as its own. the tortellino. Now, this is one of the most intricate pastas I've seen. And if you're going to eat Emilia-Romagna style, your tortellini had better be meat-filled. So, Fila cut little squares, put a dot of meat and Parmigiano filling in the center, and...
Poi prendiamo...
Now you begin.
E il quadrato lo pieghiamo a triangolo.
Okay, so now you have a square, you have stuffing in the middle. She folds it over to make a triangle, and she seals the edges.
Poi pieghiamo la punta verso l'alto.
Now the next thing you do is you turn the point of the triangle over on top of the filling.
Poi avvolgiamo il tortellino attorno all'indice e lo stringiamo.
Now, you've turned the point over the filling, and then you take the two little tails and you overlap them and pinch. And what you get is a belly button. It's amazing. Ma è fantastici.
È l'ombelico.
È l'ombelico. She says it's a belly button. It's an umbilico. It's beautiful, though, because this is... I'm talking here... I mean, we are talking... If this is a half inch in diameter, it's big. And this is the classic size for what tortellini should be. Signora Fila, grazie tantissima per questa. Molto, molto grazie.
Grazie a voi di essere venuti. Per me è stato un piacere.
Thank you so much.
Antonella Fila is the 2005 winner of the professional category in the Golden Rolling Pin competition. Now, we're picking up the trip in one of the region's classic restaurants, La Buca. It's in an old village house on the Parma Plain. Now, in the 15 years since I've been here, La Buca's not missed a beat. The place still buzzes. The culatello ham is still prime. They soak it in white wine before cutting. The parade of pastas will make you crazy. And the smack-your-lips spicy priest's hat sausage is still served with the best chutney in the world. Mothers and daughters have cooked here for years. Owner and cook, Miriam Leonardi, looks a little older, but she's still got the arms of a pasta maker and a great smile. She pulled up a chair, I poured her some wine, and we talked.
Signora Leonardi, io ricordo che io ho venuto qui per mangiare più o meno 15 anni.
I remember coming here perhaps 10 or 15 years ago and meeting you, and you told me then that La Buca was the work of the women in your family. That you married to have daughters to run the restaurant. Do you remember that?
Dunque, questo è anche vero, sì, perché almeno così.
Well, yes, it is true. We say it as a joke and we laugh, but my point is to make it clear the women counted for something. Look, I love my husband, my mother loved my father, the same with my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and so on and so on. But we always had a rule. The man could never step over the threshold of our kitchen. La Buca has always been the domain of we women. It is an ego. Women's cooking is different from men's. Women cook with the weather, the seasons. They have the persistence to protect the traditions. Instinct is the word I want. Don't misunderstand me. Men are talented, but they don't have the subservience of the palate. They can't resist changing the traditional tastes of our dishes. Fortitude and women. We have instincts, they do not. We women of the house always want to make it better than our mothers.
You said that the palate, the sense of taste, is passed from one generation to another of the women in your family. How does that happen?
Io penso che sia geneticamente la cosa, perché
for us it's natural. We have three centuries of women cooking, a passage from mother to daughter. I think it is genetic. When you have a business that lasts so many generations, you have women working together. They absorb the taste. But even if we work with our daughters, we have been the captains of our kitchens. We women find it hard to give up our power, even to our daughters. So it is like the king is dead. Long live the king. When we die, the captain's hat passes to our daughters.
How long has the restaurant been in this place?
Our family took over this building in 1897. A wine dealer had it. We started La Buca. It was an osteria, a tavern, where you had wine and simple food. So it is 108 years for us. Six generations were born in this house.
The great tradition of this part of the plain is culatello. And I understand you make your own. Can you briefly explain what makes culatello special?
We say culatello is the noble part of the pig. Here on the plain, next to the river with our fog, you can't cure a whole ham, a prosciutto. With this humidity and heat, it rots. So we divide the ham. We take the biggest muscle of the leg for culatello. We salt it, season it, tie it up into a pear shape, and hang the meat, up to 3 years, in our cantinas, our storerooms. You must understand, the most important part of the culatello is its fragrance. It's different from prosciutto. It doesn't have a skin, and it is a smaller piece of meat. So it takes aromas faster, and it's so much more sweet and intense than prosciutto, and double the price. And it's this. The fog and the cantina give the culatello its aromas, especially my cantina. Today people don't use cantinas as they used to, but we still age our wine there in barrels. And age our Parmigiano Reggiano wheels. This is essential to know. These incredible perfumes, the life of the cantina, get into the culatello. Because if you mature the culatello in a sterile factory room where you have no aromas, nothing alive, you get nothing. You get something I can't describe. You must understand, for us, in our house, it was a point of hospitality, a point of honor to serve our culatello to our guests, the people who came to eat from outside our zone. Because it was the men who slaughtered the pigs and worked the meat, but we women were responsible for the perfumes, for the aging in the cantina, for the greatness of the culatello. So that is the story.
Signora Leonardi, there is now the tradition of the culatello. There is 15 generations of cooks in your family. What about the next generation? Who will follow you?
Oh, it is a beautiful thing. From when my daughter was born, she was always following behind me. She's a wonderful cook, better than me. She went to school in Milan and has worked in agriculture, but wants la buca. And now I have a wonderful grandson. He's a boy. The tradition is broken. But I think it's okay. He'll be a chef, not like we women who are cooks. And he will innovate. Ah, but I figure we have another 50 years of the food of we women, la cucina femmina, another 50 years.
Molto grazie, signore. Molto grazie.
Grazie a voi che siete. Ah, thank you for coming and for tasting my dishes. I hope this will be a wonderful memory. And when you return to Italy, you will come to my table.
Miriam Leonardi's restaurant is La Buca in Zibello, outside of Parma. By the way, I have to tell you that her skin is a testament to the power of pasta steam. It could beat out Lancome any day of the week. Well, coming up, Verdi worship with your lunch. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, this week, we've the first of two special shows we recorded in Italy a few years ago in what many consider to be the culinary capital of Italy, Emilia-Romagna. It's the area where I spent 10 years writing and researching my first book, The Splendid Table. But believe it or not, even after all of that time, there were still places I hadn't gotten to. So we headed for the place I'd always wanted to research, but usually got so caught up in the scene I never did. It's on the coast of the Adriatic. Now, up the coast is Venice and the Abbey of Pomposa, where the musical Scale was created. Nearby is Ravenna with its fabulous Byzantine mosaics. But where we're going, all that's modern history.
I took the crew to ancient eel country, the Valley of the Camacchio. I mean, the Etruscans were trading with the Greeks 6 centuries before Christ here, and the Romans were shipping eels throughout their empire 2,000 years ago. Now, imagine great sweeps of lagoons and canals. You can't tell where the sky stops and the water begins. Old wood houses jut out over the canals on stilts, and they've got these great nets billowing out over the water. It's absolutely silent. We meet up with Franco Mezzogiorri, an eel fisherman, and he led us down a path toward a lagoon.
The salt air is... Oh, I haven't smelled this in a long time. And now we're going to actually meet eels firsthand. There are small boats, open boats, that are docked alongside us here. There's someone who's cleaning off the pavement with a machine. And you now can begin to smell the smell of the boats and seaweed. Franco, per quanti anni? For how many years have you worked with the eels? Have you been a fisherman?
Sono ormai 33 anni.
Only 33 years. But considering my father was a guard here and I'm 53 years old, I've always been here in the Camacchio.
Ah, sì. Franco, what is the tradition here of the eels? Have they always been here?
Sempre state qua.
They've always been here, migrating here from America, from the Sargasso Sea. The plankton here is the same as the Sargasso Sea. They eat this when they're small. Then they become carnivores, too.
So how do you go about catching eel?
We do it with a trap system of metal screens and cement channels. They are at the head of the lagoons, shaped like funnels. Once the eels swim in, they can have the whole lagoon, but they cannot get out. It's not only eel here. In the summer, the salt content of the water rises, so other fish come too.
I understood that this system of traps actually was created by the Romans. Questo è vero?
Questo è vero perché hanno trovato delle strutture.
Oh yes, people never believe this. They think computers do everything. No, the Romans designed this system 2,000 years ago. They did it with reeds. We do it with metal and cement. But it is the same. It works. In fact, at Spina they found the Etruscans. They were here before the Romans. The Etruscans had a system close to this. My father is 83 and remembers the same method of capturing eels.
All right, we now know how you trap the eels, but then what do you do with the eels?
The eels are caught and put in big barrels with holes in them. We keep them in the water so they purge themselves, they purify themselves. They used to go to Camacchio, where we have the famous Hall of Fire, a vast room with big shallow fireplaces all along one wall. The eels were cut up, laced on skewers, and roasted in front of the fires, marinated and packed.
You said that they are cooked in a room that is called the fire room, and you said it, this famous fire room. What does that mean?
The heart of the Camacchio is in that fire room. Here you have the history of the Camacchio, our lives, our economy, rested on the fish. You catch eels mainly from October to December. They used to catch 8-9 million pounds of eel. If they sold them all right away, the market collapsed. So our ancestors created ways to preserve them and sell eels through the year. We shipped to all of Italy, to America. First in barrels, then we took canning from you Americans, and we canned them. Our green and red cans were famous. Gradually, the catch got smaller. More land went to farming. There was overfishing, the depression, the bombs were nice enough to send in World War II, and the pollution took our eel industry down to very small.
Do you think the eels are going to come back? Is there a chance that they will return in large quantity?
Penso proprio di sì. Diciamo che in due anni...
I think the eels are coming back. The water is cleaner. In the last 2 years, we've had a change in administration. The old executives went on pension. Now our administration is younger. They are ready for change. We are greener. The water is cleaner. The fish are back. I think our production may be increasing. I hope enough to export to America.
The eels are so mysterious. There really isn't a lot known about them. Is it true that they all come from the Sargasso Sea?
No.
No.
No. Non è vero.
Not true. There are six types. The eels that come here are from Sargasso. We know eels migrate to where the waters are deeper. Molucca, the Mariani. The eels of the Pacific were born in the Pacific. The eels of the Atlantic spawn in the Atlantic. It's a myth or mystery, call it whatever you want. But what we know is true. The strength of the eel is in its tail. Like for Samson, it was his hair. That's a myth, but what's true is true for the eels. Just listen. If the environment they're in is too hot or too cold, to survive, they drill a hole in the mud with their tails. Imagine, they dig under it for yards. When they find a fissure, a trickle of fresh water or salt water, they will go miles, miles. The waters that we cleansed in the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, I mean the canals and ditches that were cut off from our lagoons that connect to the sea 50, 60 years ago, in them we find eels. So they don't just reproduce in the Sargasso Sea or deep ocean, they reproduce right here. It's 50 years these animals have no connection to the ocean. Those tails are amazing. You see the heavy metal sides that make the narrow channel under the water here? When eels don't want to be in there, I have seen them turn their tails into battered rams, break through the metal and escape. A tiger can't do that. Only the mature eels do this. The others don't have the instinct to get to the open sea.
We were about to pack it up when all of a sudden the eels arrived in a bucket.
This is the cibola. Oh.
Pian pianino, se guardiamo, se abbiamo qualche matura.
La gaula. Una matura.
Due.
The eels have been taken out of, there's a huge plastic barrel
that's
essentially been sitting, has holes in it, it's sitting down in the water, they've pulled it out with a net, and he's showing us a mature one, and the mature one has a beautiful golden silver stripe
down the
lap. Vedi la
forza che è nella coda? Non vada a te, vedi che la forza ce l'ha nella coda?
What he is saying is, look at the tail, he's holding this near the tail, the tail is absolutely rigid, it's poised, the head of the eel is not moving, but the tail's trying to escape.
Vedi che nera, le orecchie sono più accentuate, come abbiamo detto prima, il musino ce l'ha più fusolato. Se prendiamo uno di questi,
he's saying, you see the side fins or the ears are very big. These are really amazing.
Hai visto che, come detto prima, c'è questa...
Yes, see, he's saying, you see what I meant about how different the mature ones look, that they're actually beautiful. And their faces change.
E le mangeremo.
Yeah, he says, and we're going to eat these. No, but they're really amazing.
Se la rossella da via, le facevamo un rosto.
Molto grazie, Franco. Molto grazie.
Franco Mezzagori is an eel fisherman in the Camacchio. Now, the Camacchio is embraced by one of Europe's largest protected wetlands. It's called the Parco del Delta del Po, a birder's dream. Is it possible that we spent more time in a car than eating? Well, maybe. I mean, we covered every hill and dale. And one thing is sure, doing 90 miles an hour down the autostrada inspires conversation.
That's Rio Nidi?
Yeah, it's Rio Nidi.
The bad line they ship back to the United States.
Yeah, the soda pop Lambrusco.
Exactly.
Yeah, but there's a story behind it that I was told that changed my mind about it, made it more acceptable. After World War II, and this area, like much of Italy, was pretty much devastated during World War II, a lot of the partigiani, meaning the guerrilla fighters who were fighting against the government and against the Germans, were farmers. And they had always made Lambrusco. And after the war, when the land was devastated, the vineyards were devastated, they were trying to rebuild, they realized that they were almost the odd men out because they had been such outlaws. And to try to establish some sort of stability economically, they essentially formed a co-op where these Lambrusco producers came together. And the word means reunited, reuniti. And they started producing Lambrusco on a larger scale than it had ever been done before. And then they got smart and they realized they could export it to other countries. So there's this sort of mixed thing about it. You don't want to drink it, but the story behind it is kind of interesting.
It amazes me, Lynn, how much sparkling wine is here.
You know, it is kind of interesting, and I wonder if... you want to make a right here. You want to make a right here. This is what I think, okay? Because they can choose whether or not the wine sparkles.
When they make it, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And the theory I have is that the food is so rich. You know, there's so much pork here. There's so much, all this very rich stuff. The wines tend to be low in alcohol, and I think the sparkling part of it, both of those come together to make it much easier to drink. They cut through the fat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's
it. Works.
And it really does work. You can sit and enjoy. If you ordered a Chianti or a Barolo in this part of the country, it's insane. You would die. You couldn't get through a meal. Well, I mean, think of all that butter swimming on the plate with the bust.
You see, there's always a story when you travel with Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Come on now, what do you want? I mean, I hadn't been there in years. Of course there are stories to tell. And by the way, some Lambrusco is really dynamite to drink.
Io mi aspettavo, sai da te, una risposta come il fu. E invece niente, invece no. Pugno in faccia era meglio, lo so. Io mi aspettavo, sai da te.
All right, let me tell you about Giuseppe Verdi, the composer. Now, his hometown was Busseto, and it's a pretty town. It has a big statue of Verdi in the square, a theater dedicated to Verdi, a Verdi altar in the butcher shop, and a place of worship on the main street. Now, believe it or not, I'm inside of a delicatessen in Busseto. This entire store has been given over to Verdi memorabilia, and in the back are hanging salami, the culatello hams. There are tables set with white bowls, small white bowls, because here you drink wine out of a bowl. Because it's always been viewed as a food instead of a beverage. And as you walk in, there is a great chair, a carved wooden leather chair, and above it, a bust of Verdi. And it says, Memories of the Cavalier, the Noble Signore, the Pilgrim, the, what would you call him? The famous Verdi. And the bus sits as though it's actually on an altar. At the back of the store, some of the local men at Saturday morning have gathered. They're drinking wine out of the bowls, greeting each other. And that's what you hear in the background. But always Verdi. And this store has been here for as long as I can remember. So it's almost like walking into an operatic church that happens to sell food.
That was the Salsa Menteria Verdiana in Busseto. Years ago, I came across a very telling Verdi story by a local writer named Enzo Sermassi. It was in his book called The Po of Mysteries. It was about life along the Po River. He told of the local tavern where village men gathered every day. It was a place, I'm quoting here, where plastic and Coca-Cola have not passed through the door. The men there still dance together, and they sing Verdi as easily as they make conversation. Now, Sermassi said in the book that one old man told him, you know, young people don't like Verdi. I know it sounds impossible, but they don't. And then the old man grinned, and with kind of a twinkle added, but when they grow up, it changes. it's inevitable. Thanks for joining us, and join us next week for Italy Part 2. And until then, let me leave you with this old saying from Parma. It says, the pig is like the music of Verdi. There's nothing left to throw away. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find newsletters and podcasts of all stripes available for free, including our newest seasonal offering, How to Eat Supper, based on our new book called How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. So check it all out at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported in part by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Mitch Hanley recorded our Italian adventures. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke.
Jenny Lubke.
Hey, Jay Lou.
Oh, Jenny, we miss you. Ooh. You're here.
Jenny, if this doesn't sound good.
It's your problem.
Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.